And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio online at kpfa.org. Erica Bridgman is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. We type and we text and we record things in journals and books and so forth. But of course, it wasn't always that way. It used to be that people would remember prodigious amounts of information, would keep it in their heads, would relate things by memory to other people and younger folks, and in this way, stories and accounts and understandings would pass from generation to generation. Take the great orators of ancient Greece. As my guest Julie McCormick writes, while they may not have had the luxury of index cards or teleprompters, they did have the incredible powers of a mind trained in the art of memory. Julie McCormick is literary associate at Berklee Repertory Theater. She wrote a recent piece about memory, storytelling, and the ancient Greeks. She's also written about Homer and the Trojan War and about whether either can be said to have existed or happened. Not coincidentally, Berklee Rep is presenting a new adaptation of The Iliad. It's called An Iliad, and it's adapted from Homer by Lisa Peterson and Dennis O'Hare. When I sat down with Julie McCormick in our KPFA Berklee studios, I asked her about the importance of memory and storytelling to the human condition.
I would say that they're absolutely vital to the human condition, because a lot of where memory and storytelling come from is from a very neurological place in some ways. The way we remember best is when we attach a story to something. When something is remembered in strong emotion, or it's linked to a sensation, to smell, to taste, to touch, it's when it sticks with us the longest. And this happens, you know, not on purpose, but it also, when we choose to remember something, assigning a sense to it or assigning a story or an emotion helps it to lodge more firmly in our brain. It makes more connections between neurons in different parts of the brain. So storytelling is one way to do that, to form a narrative. And some of the very earliest pieces of history that we have and understanding of who we are as people comes from oral stories. You know, the great epics of the past, Beowulf and the Ramayana and the Iliad.
And why? Why develop narratives about our past? What would be our goal in telling these stories, perhaps to a younger generation?
A big part of it is record keeping. Before the days of cloud storage and audiovisual recording, even before writing, that was the way that if you wanted to preserve a piece of information for future generations, you told it in a story, because that's what was easiest to remember.
And there is something about our younger people learning something from our experiences.
Yes. I mean, you have not only the desire to keep information, like there is this stream has water that is good to drink, but you also preserving a sense of culture and identity. I think it's been very interesting to watch, as technology has changed over time, how the sense of the individual has changed as well. You know, a lot of the myths from Paleolithic times, there's no sense of individuals. There's sense of great natural forces, of gods and goddesses, but not of the people who were telling these stories. So I think there's a sense of wanting to pass down some kernel of yourself and your knowledge and your experience, but not necessarily being able to pass down a sense of who you are personally. And I think as our abilities have changed and increased, we've been able to pass down specific information, specific technical information that we would like people to have, but also ideas about the world and what we've done wrong, what we wish we did better, what we're proud of, and then also a sense of self. You know, who the grandmother was that your children will never meet. What was she like? That is something that we can share. And that's something that we can share orally through oral histories and stories that we tell each other, but also through writing and through photographs.
Walter Ong, he taught for a long time at St. Louis University. How did he characterize or categorize societies?
Walter Ong kind of divided the world into two main categories. There's the cultures that have had exposure to the written word, and then there are cultures that have not. And he calls that oral residue. So there are some cultures with a very high oral residue and some with a very low. And nowadays, it's pretty much impossible to find a culture or society that has not had some contact with the written word. And so the way that we as a culture process information is very dependent upon that. So in America, in the Western world, it's a society with a very high oral residue, whereas in some more remoter parts of the world, it is still based on this oral storytelling and these traditions. There's a very interesting article that appeared a number of years ago about revenge cultures in Papua New Guinea that do have this sense of storytelling and passing down lineage and honor that's actually surprisingly similar to Bronze Age Greece. There are a lot of themes that show up in the Iliad, which is very interesting.
And earlier when you were saying industrial societies have a higher oral residue, you meant lower oral residue, is that right? Or no?
Yes, okay. I did. Thank you.
Okay. So let's talk about the Greece of, say, Socrates' day. Was it more of an oral or a writing-based society?
See, that's very interesting because Socrates fell at a time that was a transitional period between a primarily oral culture entering into one that was more literary. So back in the antiquity and archaic Greece, there wasn't necessarily writing, or it wasn't used for recording information quite as much. So everyone would memorize everything. And there was this scholar named Simonides, who is sort of termed the father of memory. And he came up with this very interesting mnemonic system whereby you would create structures in your mind to help you remember pieces of information. So sort of the most famous example is memory palaces. You would create a house in your mind and walk through each room, and everything that you wanted to remember would be assigned a place in the house or a symbolic object. And what that does is that keeps your memories inside of you, internal. It becomes a part of you. You're a walking memory palace. You're a walking library. And writing became a way to externalize those things. And Socrates was actually not in favor of writing as a way of keeping memories, because it meant that you didn't truly internalize it. It didn't become a part of you. It was a memory aid as opposed to a true memory.
Yeah, in fact, you cite in this article in the Berkeley Rep magazine, you cite this story as related by Plato, but it's a story of Socrates, of what happened when a king was presented a gift of letters by a god, correct? Can you just go over that a little bit?
Sure. What happened is that the Egyptian god Thoth, god of knowledge, gave writing to the king Thammuz. And the king said, "Thank you very much for this gift. However, I don't really want this, because I know you're very excited about it, but this is not true knowledge. This is not true memory. This is a trick."
And it's a trick because, as you said before, it replaces something much more important, which is the ability to recollect, the ability to learn.
Exactly.
So what do we know about how good the ancient Greeks were at reciting from memory long poems and speeches?
Well, they were very good at it because they were trained to do so. They had a number of mnemonic tools at their fingertips, and society was just, academia was structured differently. So in ancient Greece, everyone was expected to do so. That was a sign of knowledge and of understanding. So in addition to the memory palaces, they also had other devices. One orator was thought to take the signs of the zodiac and then to assign pieces of his speeches to each section of the zodiac. And another part of that is how information was structured. It wasn't only how they remembered it, but also how it was parceled, because they were remembering long poems, long epic poems, which are very different to memorize than, say, a novel is today or a software instruction book, because the language is very repetitive, which is easier to remember. It has a simpler grammar. Rather than having complex sentences with subordinating conjunctions and, you know, independent clauses and all that, it's very simple. So lots of ands, lots of coordinating conjunctions, lots of rhyme, which helps you to remember. it's much easier to pull a word out of the air if you have another one to link it to, and then also in verse. The Iliad is in dactylic hexameter, and Shakespeare is in iambic pentameter, whereas a lot of poetry now might be in verse, but not quite so strictly.
I'm speaking with Julie McCormick. She is literary associate at Berklee Repertory Theater, and she wrote two very interesting articles, one on memory and one on the Trojan War, for the Berklee Rep magazine. Currently at Berklee Rep is An Iliad, which is adapted from Homer, and we will talk about that show in a little while. You also write about Vedic chanting, which involves a great deal of memorization. So we are talking about ancient Indian texts, right?
Which is very interesting because the Iliad has changed over time fairly significantly. It was a story. It wasn't necessarily a religious text. Whereas in Vedic religions, there's a distinction between Shruti and Smriti texts. And so Shruti is heard literature, heard directly from God, heard directly from divinity, that you pass down exactly as it is. And that's incredibly key, to pass it down exactly, because there is something divine in uttering those words, in those sacred sounds. Whereas Smriti is remembering rules of law. And so the Vedas are Shruti texts, so you want to remember them exactly as they are. You help bring them into being by speaking them. So part of the way that these were memorized was by assigning them to specific sounds. So words had a specific tone, and I think there were three tones that you would stick with. And you would memorize the tones alongside the words in different patterns. And I saw a very interesting anthropological documentary from the 70s of doing a Vedic or pre-Vedic ritual in a South Indian village. And you were watching children learning these different patterns. And their teacher would take their heads and would move it from side to side, front and back. And that would be assigned with a tone. So you would have the word, you would have the sound, and you would have the movement to link everything together.
Synesthesia is a neurological condition often associated with artists. What is synesthesia?
So synesthesia is when you associate multiple senses with each other. So for example, you might associate color with letters or numbers. Another common one is associating music with color, or perhaps numbers with music. And some of them get very rare and interesting. There's one man out there who associates taste with texture. So when he tastes something, he feels an object in his hand that has weight and temperature and texture. And it's fairly common. About 1 in 20 people have some form of synesthesia. And we don't really know why it happens or how it happens, really. But it's also an interesting aid to memory and to art, because, again, if you have something to remember other than the thing you want to remember, I have synesthesia, for example, and I associate letters and numbers with color. So if I want to remember a phone number, I don't just remember the number, I also remember the color pattern. So that's not particularly artistically interesting. But when you end up with artists like Kandinsky or Nabokov, who connect color or sound, say, with an idea, then you end up with very interesting, evocative pieces. So something, you know, like Fantasia, the Disney film, is a perfect example of synesthesia in art, linking music with stories and with visual patterns. And the term was actually an artistic term before it was a scientific one. The study of synesthesia only came about in maybe the early 1900s, but for a couple hundred years before then, it was used to describe art that was drawing on multiple senses.
And when you say it's easier to remember something if you are remembering something alongside it, that might strike people as counterintuitive, right? Because they think, well, that makes it harder if I have to remember more than one thing. But I think you are saying the association, the more associations you can make, the more likely you are to remember what you are trying to remember.
Exactly. And that has a lot to do with the way that memory is fixed in the brain. A complete memory doesn't live in one pinpoint in one part of the brain. A memory is actually more like a web or a lattice work. that's in many different parts of the brain. So the more connective tissue you have, literally, the more physical connections that are there in your brain, the easier it is to recall that, because you can approach it from many different directions.
Well, let's move back in time to the ancient Greeks. There is a play at Berkeley Rep called An Iliad, not The Iliad, but An Iliad. It's adapted from Homer. And speaking of which, who was Homer? What do we know about this guy?
Not a whole lot. For a long time, there was this idea of Homer as a blind poet wandering through Greece and telling his stories and in taverns and around campfires. But that's a more romantic construction of Homer. Now, it's pretty widely agreed that Homer was probably not one person, that the story was not composed by an auteur, but rather people telling the story over and over again. So what they think probably happened is it was a legend that people would share, that they would embellish, that there were some core moments that remained, and then someone at some point finally wrote it down. And we don't know exactly when that happened either. The oldest existing textual version of the Iliad is from, I think, the 10th century AD, something like that. So it had a several thousand year history before it ever made it to the page.
If a Homer did exist, do we know when and where he might have lived?
Homer probably lived sometime around 800 BC, and the events of the Trojan War likely occurred maybe 1200 BC, so 400 years before Homer would have lived. And Homer would not have written this down. It's a chance that he maybe told the story to a scribe and they wrote it down. And we're not entirely sure where Homer is from. You think that he would be Greek because an Iliad kind of follows, or the Iliad rather, follows the Greek perspective. It's in Greek. But they've done some linguistical analysis and also looked at the places that are described in the Iliad, and they're so detailed that they think he may have actually lived in a Greek settlement in Turkey, which is where the historical site of Troy was. So he actually may have lived at or near Troy.
So Troy has been located at a specific place in what is current-day Turkey?
Yes, that is correct. They found a city that they believe to be Troy. They can't know for certain. But back in the 1800s, a German named Schliemann was working with a British archaeologist and found this site that was called Troy. It has a number of other names, Ilion, Wallusa, that had a Roman city built on top that had been ruined and abandoned. And as they excavated, they found a number of cities beneath that had been built upon the ruins of another. And they found a city, the seventh layer of Troy, that they think was happening at the same time as the events of the Trojan War, and it was destroyed by fire. So, which is how Troy is destroyed in the legend of the Trojan War.
Which brings us to the question of whether the Trojan War actually happened or whether it's a mythical event. Is there an historical consensus about that?
There is a conflict that happened at that time in Troy. We don't have very much specific information about those events. The information we do have, a lot of that is coming from the Iliad and the Odyssey and other epic poems about the Trojan War, which, because of their oral nature, are also myths in and of themselves. So much of the fabric of the Iliad and the Odyssey deals with the gods and how the gods have influenced events among mortals. And, you know, if the explanation is that Athena did it, how do we have a modern equivalent for that?
Sure. So according to legend and myth, how did the Trojan War begin? What ignited it?
The gods. Who else? At a wedding, the goddesses Hera, Athena, and Aphrodite had a competition to see who was the most beautiful, and they asked the Trojan prince Paris to judge the competition, and they each promised him something, some bribe, should he choose them. And Aphrodite's bribe was Helen of Greece, Menelaus's wife, who was the most beautiful woman in the world, and Paris wanted Helen, so declared Aphrodite the winner. He went to Greece and stole Helen away, as well as a lot of treasure, and sparked the war between the Greeks and the Trojans.
Yeah, Paris took Helen back to Troy, and the Greeks were outraged, and so then they sent all their folks, and there was this, what, a 10-year siege of Troy, correct?
Yes, there was a 10-year siege at Troy. Tens of thousands of Greek soldiers from all over the islands came to fight for the return of Helen. And there's a lot of speculation amongst historians, but also amongst artists, what that meant. Was it really over Helen? Was it over honor? Was it over money? Was it over a trade route? Because Troy was also very conveniently located at the Hellespont, so the entrance into a major waterway. So we're not really sure. I guess it's whatever makes the best story that you're trying to tell.
Julie McCormick is a literary associate at Berkeley Repertory Theater. My name is C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. At Berkeley Repertory Theater, you can see An Iliad. It's an Obie Award-winning play adapted from Homer by Lisa Peterson and Dennis O'Hare. The show runs through November 18th. For tickets and information, you can click on the link we've provided at againstthegrain.org. Or you can call the box office, which is open Tuesday through Sunday from noon to 7 at 510-647-2949, 510-647-2949. Julie, how would you describe Berkeley Rep's current production of An Iliad?
I think An Iliad does a wonderful job of telling many different stories in many different ways. Sometimes you're sitting there and it feels like you're around a campfire and Homer is speaking to you directly, and then other times it has a very contemporary feel. It's a very powerful piece that connects with you on many levels. You connect individually with the person, with the people in front of you, because there's a musician as well as an actor. But then there's also a strong sense of connection to history, to the people in these stories, and to the people around you. It's a very communal event that feels vital that it is a piece of theater.
What does the actor, and he is on stage and you see the bassist in another part of the theater, but what does the actor who is called the poet, what is he doing on stage over this 100-minute production?
Henry Warnitz is telling us the story of the Trojan War. He's telling us specifically a moment from the Iliad, which is a very small, small piece of the conflict. And he's telling the story in many ways, which is very exciting how he transitions between all of them. There's some Greek recitation, only a very little bit, though. You don't need to bring a dictionary with you, but there's also a fair amount of recitation directly from the Fagles translation, which is what they used in their adaptation.
Robert Fagles, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. But then also, there's also contextualizing it for us in terms of our contemporary world, but then also with other wars in history. So there'll be this very epic moment where he's describing a conflict in one war, and then you'll slowly realize that he's talking about something that happened 100 years ago or something that could have happened to you yesterday. And it just makes it very vital and alive in a way that I don't think we often approach ancient texts anymore. I mean, it's very much a historical, dry academic, whereas this feels very alive.
And, you know, there could have been a staging involving a lot of actors, and each actor is a character in the Iliad, and so they're all interacting. So you have in this play one storyteller, one person telling all these stories. Now, I'm guessing from what we were talking about earlier in regard to storytelling and memory that it might be very appropriate, in your opinion or many other people's opinions, that this presentation, this production is all about one person holding forth.
Absolutely. And that's the way the story was originally told. It was one person. As Lisa Peterson has said, it's the original spoken word event was telling these stories. And I think there's something else, too, to connecting over the telling of the story and not just seeing it. You know, if it was with many different characters, if it was trying to depict the events of the war, I think you would lose a lot of that context. It would just be about watching the events. There wouldn't be this additional sense of connection to my world. It would be a bit more escapist, I think.
So you have this play, and An Iliad really seems to focus on sort of the horrors of war, right? So you have all these people dying, you have fields covered with blood. Let's talk about the Iliad. is the Iliad an anti-war play?
That's a difficult question, I think, because it's all about our apprehension of it. I personally have not read the Iliad in its entirety. It's over 15,000 lines, but that's next on my reading list. I think it's more, I think the Iliad and an Iliad are more about exploring the cost of war, the cost to the people who are engaged in it, and the cost of telling the story, and the cost of hearing the story, and the cost of war in our lives. And I think it's difficult to really explore that and really engage with that without coming away with anti-war sentiments. But I don't think that that's necessarily their intention. There's so much more to it than the horror of war as well. It's also, you know, a word that doesn't necessarily mean as much to us today as it used to, but it's about glory and honor and the beauty of a band of brothers.
And it's about humanity, right? And the human condition and human desire and maybe some human instincts that we don't like to think that we have. And in that regard, could you just give us a glimpse into the kind of the main event of this production, right? So you have Achilles, who was the Greek hero, the warrior par excellence, and then you have Hector, who was the leader of the Trojans, right? So can you tell us a little bit about the conflict between the two that is perhaps the kernel of the production and Iliad?
Sure. It's also, I think, the kernel of the Iliad as well, following these two. Achilles is the greatest warrior of the Greeks. He's half god. And the play starts when, and the story, starts when Agamemnon wants to take away Achilles' prize. And Achilles gets very angry at this greedy behavior and decides to withdraw from the fighting. So part of it is about Achilles stepping away for a moment from the war, which, when you think about it, is a very interesting way to introduce a warrior, is his decision to not fight. And then Hector is the Trojan, the eldest Trojan prince, and he's leading the Trojan forces. And he's a very interesting guy because he's not bloodthirsty necessarily. He's also, or put it this way, his portrait is more complex than that. He's also a son, a husband, a father, and their conflict kind of drives the action of what happens in Iliad.
Yeah, there's a very dramatic denouement, and it's beautifully told by the star of An Iliad at Berklee Repertory Theater. And again, if you want to check out the play or get more information, it runs through November 18th, by the way, at Berklee Rep. You can click on the link we've provided at againstthegrain.org, or you can call the box office at 510-647-2949. That's 647-2949. Julie McCormick is literary associate at Berklee Rep Theater. And we, by the way, we have a link on our website, againstthegrain.org, to the Berklee Rep magazine, in which you can read, it's a PDF file, in which you can read Julie's very interesting articles. Julie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you will find on-demand and downloadable audio, and you can sign up there for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, and check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.